Weird? Does it sound weird? Is that okay? Maybe it's Kathy.
I'm weird.
Okay. So let me take just a few moments to kind of recap some of what we've covered up until now, and then go on this evening and talk about unrequited desire for evil. So we're looking at these two sets of teachings and companionship with each other. One is called the personality types or tendencies, and that's a teaching that's found in the Visuddhimagga, which was created by these monks in Sri Lanka about 1,000 years after the Buddha passed away. It's kind of a user's guide to the Pali Canon. You know, it's kind of a compendium of their experience over time. One of the things that they noticed over time is that this teaching, one of the Buddha's core teachings about the sources of suffering in the mind, the tendencies in the mind toward greed, hate, and delusion, that as those patterns become ingrained in one's consciousness over the course of a lifetime, they begin to form patterns of reactivity. Okay. And that depending on what your life experience has been, and perhaps genetic predilection or whatever, that one or another of those torments of the mind, or poisons as they're sometimes called, will tend to be dominant. Whether it happens to be aversion, you know, continuously thrusting away that which you do not want, that is part of your existence, or whether it might be craving and greed, okay. And, okay, it's much worse now than it was, so. Who knows? I will have to make my peace with this thing. Right, that's something I don't want to be like it is when it makes that kind of noise.
Dukkha.
Yes. Greed or craving, you know, whereas the first is wanting something to go away that's in your environment that you don't like. Okay. Craving is wanting something that you don't have. Okay. Sometimes I like to watch the weather. It's probably my favorite part of the news because it's the most predictable. So if you look at the weather and the maps and whatnot, if you see like a high pressure zone, you know, it's turning clockwise and it's thrusting winds out in all directions and whatnot, that's kind of like the aversive personality, right? It's pushing things away. Whereas the greedy type or the craving type of personality is like a low pressure zone, where it's counterclockwise kind of sinkhole. It's pulling, always trying to pull things in from the outside, never getting enough. And then the deluded mind is kind of like the doldrums, right? So these monks in the Visuddhimagga, they said, well, you know, if indeed, you know, these patterns begin to emerge, the kind of simile that I use from modern times that some of you have probably heard me rely on before, is like a jazz combo, you know, and a jazz trio will be put together by you know, one like Oscar Peterson or Diana Krall or somebody like that, you know, and they're the person that kind of organizes the music and they usually take the lead, but the other members of the combo from time to time play long riffs as well. And so the teaching of personality types is, it's basically a way to think about or conceptualize, maybe develop some insights into your personal predilections. Okay. So it's like, who's the leader of your band? You know, who's the lead player in your trio? Is it aversion? Is it attachment? Is it delusion? Okay. Doesn't mean that the other two sidemen or women aren't gonna play riffs every now. It's just that for the most part, you tend to revert. Your default option tends to be one of those three. And it can be a useful construct as long as you don't get carried away with it. There's this tendency, you know, to kind of identify with whatever's going on in the mind. So you can say, oh, I'm a greedy type, or I'm an aversive type, or whatever. And the more skillful way to understand this teaching is it is kind of a predilection. It's a tendency that is a product of our karma. You know, our wiring plus our experience that tends for us to kind of respond in certain ways. And so it can be used skillfully if you just use it to reflect upon how it is, what are the lenses through which you happen to be seeing the world and interacting with the world. In some instances, you'll find, much to your delight, that none of these seems to be particularly strong. And it feels to you like you have a relatively clear vision of what's going on around you. Okay. Other times, not so much. You know, in the classic teachings, like for instance, the Thai meditation master, forest meditation master Ajahn Chah, you know, used to use the simile of the mind as a clear forest pool. And then these classic forms of disturbance of the pool, anger is like if the water in the pool is boiling instead of being clear. Greed and craving are as if a brightly colored dye was poured into the water. So you're seeing through this haze of desire. You know, you're always scanning the environment for what you want but don't have. Mm-hmm. You know, whether it's gratification of the senses and kind of the immediate sense, more broadly can be understood as wanting the perfect job or the right relationship or more money. Anything that you really want that you don't have, that you are convinced that your life will not be complete without. Okay. So that's the nature of the craving mind. Somebody really wants me to go online with the password, and in the process they've done in my document. Hang on just a second here. So these hindrances that can arise, if they're really strong, mindfulness is out the window. There's no concentration. There's no ability to do anything other than be absorbed in that, in the mind state, whether it's the aversive state or the craving state or the dull state or the anxious and worried state or the doubting mind. The antidote for all of those, for all of them, is mindfulness, is simply being able to see what's going on. It's viewing the pool and saying, oh, it's turbid, oh, it's grown over with algae, you know, the sloth and torpor, you know, bubbling, or the strong winds that are rippling over the surface, you know, the nature of anxiety. So, first simply being able to recognize whatever lens that you're looking at the world through is really important. For me, it's also helpful from time to time to throw in this other teaching that is related. Of course, everything the Buddha ever taught is related to everything else, but some, it's easier to see some connections more than others. In classic Buddha Dharma, there is this teaching about realms of existence. You know, and this, the in the full-blown, kind of fully articulated system, there are like 31 different hierarchical realms of existence. And in the old days, and in Asia even today, when the monks are offering this teaching, it's kind of like Bible stories. There's realms in here that are kind of like hell and heaven and whatnot, and they teach them literally, you know, that these are the different places that you might fall into, and they're teaching about it in terms of things like, you know, rebirth. You know, you kill a monk or a nun, cause a rift in the sangha. This is a way of keeping people quiet, or do something else terrible like that, and you're going to wind up in a hell realm, a realm of ceaseless, unremitting, severe suffering of body and mind. Next realm up is the animal realm. And the animal realm was one in which sentient beings experience the pleasant and the unpleasant and the neutral. But they don't understand where these things are coming from, and they don't have any control over them. They're receptors of what the world has to offer, but they're ignorant of its sources, nor have they any control over it. The next realm up is what's called the hungry ghosts. Okay. And the hungry ghosts in Japanese Buddhist iconography, they're depicted as these beings with huge swollen bellies and teeny little heads and mouths. Okay. So they're always hungry. They can never get enough to satisfy their desires. They live in a perpetual state of unrequited desire. Next realm up is the asuras, or sometimes that word's translated as titans. It's kind of like in these video games where these monsters are in continuous conflict. And it's a state of perpetual conflict, being at war with others. Okay. The fifth realm is the human realm. All the realms above, the Deva realms, and there's several of those, the Brahma realms, and there's some of those are these heavenly realms, okay, where the mind is in a perfect state of balance and delight and complete insight and whatnot. So we have these Deva realms and Brahma realms above, and we have the realms of perpetual conflict and unrequited desire and animal dumbness and, you know, whatnot below. The human realm is supposed to be this balance point where sukha and dukkha, you know, where the suffering and unsatisfactoriness of life and the selfless joy of life are in some degree of balance. And all these teachings, the human realm is the only one through which there is a portal of access to ultimate enlightenment. The reason being that the beings in the Deva realms and the Brahma realms don't suffer. They're living in states of perpetual delight. And they have forgotten what it's like to be suffering humans. And that being the case, they really dig into being there, and they don't want things to get any different. It also means that as long as they're attached to being that realm, they can't come back and rebirth as a human in order to obtain ultimate enlightenment. And the Buddha had this kind of wry twist on the received doctrines of his time. You know, he was born into the world of the Vedic traditions, you know, and the understanding was that throughout one's practice, whatever caste you happen to be born into, and you do the purifications and you get reborn into a higher caste, and then ultimately when you're reborn as a Brahmin, your souls continue to be purified. And, you know, for instance, like in Vedic traditions, like some of the yogas, when there is this salute or this homage where you say namaste, you know, I honor the divine in you. I honor the Atman in you. Okay, and that in their teaching becomes one after endless stages of purification with Brahman, you know, the omniscient, omnipotent, all-knowing one. And the Buddhists didn't disavow the existence of Brahma. He said, you know, Brahma's only problem is that he lives in a deluded state. He thinks that he's omniscient and omnipotent. So he acknowledges Brahma, but within this larger context, not as the be-all and end-all. So there are the two ways that that's classically taught. One is, like I say, kind of like the Bible story. This is what happens if you do or don't do well in this lifetime. You're going to wind up in one of these places next time around. The other way, however, so that's kind of the literal way it was sometimes taught. The more figurative way, however, in my view, really has perhaps a greater degree of potency, at least for our purposes in this day and age. Because in that way, what it's describing is states of mind that the human consciousness moves among. Okay. So if you're blissed out and you're in a delighted state of mind, you're doing deep samadhi practices or something like that, you might find yourself in one of these states of bliss or happiness. Okay, in one of the deva realms. If the mind is really getting calm and you're experiencing the dissolution of self and whatnot, then you find yourself in the Brahma realms, experiencing what the Buddha called looking outward through the windows and the doors of the houses of Brahma, that the Brahma Viharas, which is those, what those are, becomes your lived experience, right? On the other hand, if you're having a really bad day, you can find the consciousness descending into one of these other realms instead. So if you're finding yourself in a highly aversive state of mind, okay, then you're in the realm of the Titans. You're in perpetual conflict, you're angry, you're in an adversarial relationship with your environment, okay, and those around you, and or in an adversarial relationship with your spouse. Okay. If you find yourself in the hungry ghost realm, you are in a state of perpetual craving. And then, of course, if enough already, I want out of here, you deliberately wish to be in a state of not knowing, of ignorance, of shutting the world out, of dullness. When we talk about sloth and torpor and dullness when we get together next time, it seems like you're just stuck in quicksand, nothing's going on. But in fact, that's not the case at all. What's going on is a tremendous conflict happening within the consciousness between the desire to know and the desire to not know. And when you begin to develop insight into the nature of that conflict, then things start to kind of clear up a lot. Tonight, however, we're focusing mostly on this realm of greed, of unrequited desire. So I want to offer a couple of anecdotes, a couple of personal experience. And then I would like for us to open up to discussion whether this particular construct or way of looking at things has any relevance for you and any ways that you think it might apply to your own situation if you have any questions about it. What happens eventually after you, it's kind of a process, knowing that these ways of thinking about things exist, that you can get some idea of what's your default option, how do you seem to be perceiving the world generally. And then, if you are able to be mindful of when you find yourself, when the consciousness has come to rest in one of these states of mind, whether it's a highly aversive state, a lot of anger, or a state of intense craving, unrequited desire, or a state of dullness, but right now we'll focus mostly just on those first two. Mindfulness is really crucial and important in order to become aware of the fact that this is where the mind has come to rest. Aha! I'm in an aversive state. I am in a craving state, whatnot. Whether or not it happens to be the leader of the trio or sideman doing a riff, that's what seems to be going on right now. So first, but especially if it's a powerful one you find yourself going back to again and again. Okay. The first is developing awareness of the fact that your consciousness has come to rest there. When the mindfulness is well established, then you can turn your attention not just to being, oh yeah, well, right, here I am, stuck here in Lodi again. I'm back in that particular frame of mind. The next step, when the mindfulness is strong and the mind is relatively calm, is to inquire into the nature of that mind state. What's really going on here? Why am I feeling so aversive? What's the object of my aversion? What's the strength of my feeling? Okay. What's happening? How do I feel threatened by what's going on? Or in the state of desire, what's the object of desire? How strong is it? Does it fluctuate? Okay. How would my life be perfect or fulfilled if that desire was satisfied. Many, many years ago, when teacher and friend Jack Kornfield was sitting for years with Ajahn Chah in a rural forest monastery in eastern Thailand. Been there for some time and taken vows, he was in robes, and he was just in it for the long haul. He actually wind up sitting for several years in Thailand with either Ajahn Chah or Ajahn Buddhadasa from time to time, very dedicated. So one of these periods of study where he'd been sitting for quite a long time, you know, alone out in his hut in the jungle and coming in for interviews and whatnot, doing chores around the monastery. Every time he went to sit, what would happen would be these really powerful sexual fantasies. They would just come over him every time, over and over and over again. Every time he would sit down, the mind would be concentrated and whatnot, be a fresh reel of some X-rated movie. You know, it'd just come back again and again and again. The mind could go nowhere else. And he's tried to sit with the other guy, rising, passing. Nope, it was rising and it wasn't passing. It was just what was going on, you know. It's like this nasty film festival. It just wouldn't stop, you know. And so he'd go and talk to Ajahn Chah and say, what is happening here? You know, what's going on? Why can't I shape this one? Why is it, you know, so completely absorbed my mind and what's going on? And basically, well, Ajahn Chah says it's because you're not looking at it closely enough.
Because
we're talking now about kind of gradations of practice. First stage is to get mindful and clean and aware. And then secondly, you can practice this mindful inquiry, you know, say, what's going on? Why does the mind continue to go to that place? What's behind it? And Jack says that what he realized after he began to just turn his attention to really focus on what's behind the movie screen? Why is this happening? He came to realize that he was tremendously lonely. You know, he was all alone out there in the jungle. No one else spoke English. You know, he was getting by with his tie, and he was following these 235 precepts, and he was this, you know, young ardent practitioner out there, and he was terribly alone. And he was terrified that he was going to spend the rest of his life alone. You know, that if he stayed in robes and remained a mendicant monk and whatnot, that would be his life forever. And he felt just absolute despair in his loneliness. And once he was able to see that that was the true driving force behind the craving, it abated. He was able to put it in context. He was able to see what was going on. He gained insight into the relationship between his thoughts and his emotions, his feelings. Okay. And the world opened up for him in a broader way, and the obsessive desires, you know, weakened, became less, and at some point just fell away. So it was a moment of real, what we call a path moment, a moment of insight into some powerful force at work in our minds that leaves us with this sense of freedom, having kind of come unlinked from our karma in some kind of important way. Personal experience in this general realm is one that's very fresh in my mind, since I'm still kind of working with it. As sometimes happens when I'm feeling sorry for myself during the winter, between Thanksgiving and New Year's, I managed to put on 5 pounds. You know, pretty much, you know, just eating and drinking everything in sight. Because I was trying to make myself feel better, right? And then after the holiday, my birthday's on February 9th, so I thought, okay, after the New Year's, I'm going to start losing weight here so I get back down, you know, lose this weight I just put on, certainly by the time my birthday rolls around. Guess what? Nada, no progress whatsoever. And so this is my 70th birthday, so we had kind of made a big deal out of it. We went out to see close friends and family in the San Francisco Bay Area. My brother flew in from Hawaii, and we go out and hang out on the beach, and Everybody in this group is pretty good cooks, so we ate well. And then when we weren't eating in, we'd go to all our favorite restaurants. You know, and we'd do Burmese, and we'd do Thai, and we'd do Mediterranean, we did tapas. And then, of course, they threw a couple of birthday parties for me where we brought in all our favorite foods and yucked it up. And a lot of the people at these parties were folks I used to play music with back when we lived in the Bay Area, so there was a lot of music going around. And it just felt like this sort of total deva realm, right? And when I'd sit in the mornings, I was doing metta, you know, may I be happy. I realized that I was happy, you know, and I was feeling peace of mind, you know, and I did feel free from all inner and outer harm. And it was just absolutely delightful, you know, that entire period of time. And then we came back home again, and the next morning I got on the scales, you know. And believe it or not, I managed to gain another 5 pounds, you know, way more than I ever had in my life. And all the clothes in my closet had shrunk. And, you know, nothing was fitting right, is fitting right. And I all of a sudden realized that I, you know, wasn't in Oz anymore, and I was back in Kansas. And I said, you know, this is unacceptable. You know, this has just gotta stop. And so, you know, I fired up the food diary app on my phone, and I started keeping track of everything, and began this, you know, long, arduous process of trying to take off a little bit at a time all this weight that had so gleefully and quickly, you know, taken over my body. Which left me with the necessity to start developing a relationship with hunger. Okay. Because before that time, you know, during all this period of time, as soon as there was any little hint of hunger, you know, of an emptiness or something, then I'd run off and satisfy it, right? And realizing the fix that I'd gotten myself into, it became obvious that for my own health and well-being, you know, hoping to, you know, look, you know, be around for the next few birthdays, this weight just really had to come off. And so I actually, you know, have begun to do the things I know I need to do as far as getting the weight off. Just, you know, eating less, being more mindful of what I do eat, trying to make sure I get some exercise every now and then, little bit by little bit. You know, it's like trying to turn an oil tanker, and it's like, I can feel just a few degrees, you know, a pound here. So it's starting to happen. But in the process of this going on, I've had ample opportunity to look at what the nature of this craving was. This craving that would not be denied. It would immediately be stated every time it arose. Ultimately, to my real detriment. You know. And what's going on here? So I began to really inquire, you know, just like Jack was. Okay. And a couple of things gradually began to come into focus. One is that, you know, we attach cultural baggage to certain ages, you know, one of them being 70, that, you know, pretty good chance that more of my life is behind me than in front of me. The days seem to progressively go by a little faster than they did before, even the winter ones. And so there's that, you know, just the three messengers, you know, aging, infirmity, and death. Somehow or another, it seems a little closer. The other thing is that, oh, a mere 78 days from now, but who's counting, will be the last day of my 30th year of service on the University of Colorado faculty. You know, retiring at the end of the spring term. And looking, you know, this, so for me, this is what was behind the screen. This is what was behind the curtain. First, you know, the three messengers, that's there they are, and they simply need to be befriended or acknowledged, or a more intimate relationship with them developed. you know, the sooner you do that in life, the, you know, the easier it'll be for the rest of your life. And now it's becoming quite evident that those are, you know, those are facts of life that I simply need to become more accepting of and more open to. The other is this sense of loss of who I am attendant upon retiring from a profession I've been practicing 30 years. I'm already started to do it. I'm not signing up for any more committees. I'm not doing any more writing. I'm, you know, I'm making sure that my students are well seen to and whatnot on the, in the classes that I'm teaching. But beyond that, I'm shutting it down. I'm giving away my books. I'm, you know, I'm in the process of deconstructing the professorial persona. And what I came to realize, you know, in terms of the gorging, you know, the gluttony and whatnot, is that it was my way of psychologically trying to resist that. You know, it's a fear of that persona, that construct of self, is in fact kind of in the process of dissolving. You know, like in Star Trek, it's a beam me up, Scotty, and all of a sudden all you see is little points of light and hope is solid no longer is. Well, that feels like I'm kind of gradually being beamed up. That this persona, this construct, is in the process of relaxing back into, you know, the primordial loose. You know, and who knows, you know, what's, I mean, that's this little thing I'm wearing around my neck, you know, as a symbol for Patechi Samupada, you know, dependent code, you know, dependent origination. The continuous recombinant arising and passing of all phenomena, right? Okay. And that's all that's really happening here, except that was brought into painful awareness of the degree of attachment to that persona, that way of being. Okay. And somehow or another, I had it up here that by creating more physical substance, you know, by feeding this deeper hunger that I wasn't even aware that I had, that somehow I was going to stave that off or keep it from happening. So as I experience hunger now, it has two distinct components. One is just the physical sensation, you know, the body being aware of the fact that it's not being crammed with calories in the way that it has been for the last 6 weeks or so. Okay. But the other is the kind of anxiety that's provoked by that sensation. And at least now I'm at the point where I can distinguish between the two. You know, and it's that's the nature of obsessive attachment to anything, whether it's alcohol or food or anything else. You know, there's the physiological response component, and then there is the emotional or the affective aspect of it. And it's the latter that tends to drive the former. If the latter is not so strong, not so controlling, then it becomes easier to deal with the physical hunger as it arises. So, I don't know, when I'm, you know, wake up in the middle of the night really feeling like I gotta have a snack or I'm gonna die, it's you know, it can kind of be small comfort, but it is comfort nonetheless, because I at least now have some insight or some understanding of what's going on that I didn't before, and realize that while I thought I was in a deva realm, what I was actually doing is preparing myself to plunge into a hell realm, you know, or at least into the realm of the Titans, because then I find myself in, you know, a life or death struggle with myself over, you know, and all the attendant feelings of self-aversion, and, you know, what, me being ashamed of myself for gluttony and whatnot, that kind of goes along with that. And then every once in a while falling back into the hungry ghost realm and kind of, you know, if I only had this or that or the other thing to eat, then I'd feel better and I'd be happy again, you know. And then there's another part that says, well, no. So I had to clamber back up into the human realm again, you know, seeking that balance point between sukha and dukkha, you know, just realizing. But that's what the mindfulness makes possible. That then creates a stable base for mindful inquiry, and what's really going on. And then as soon as the inquiry kicks in, you can clearly see and some insights begin to arise. That has the effect of beginning to disempower the strength of the craving. You know, it begins to wind down, to disempower, to defuel the strength of the craving, certainly the psychological aspect of it, you know, even though the physical part may still be there. And it's, you know, nice work if you can get it. I mean, it's the game I'm playing now, and I'm playing it with what feels like more insight and more skill than I was when I was just saturated in desire. Okay. That's the general approach, then that's been my experience with it. I'd certainly like to hear yours if anything that I've said has any resonance for you. Please, Jim.
I was just thinking about Ben and Jerry's low-fat Froyo. That's my way of getting around it. It's low-fat, it's okay.
Right. There you go. Right. Low-fat. How much lower than, you know, what it was? Oftentimes, not so much.
But if it's no-fat, it's like, why bother?
Well, I was going to ask you, as you were working with this process, did you feel when you feel that pull, you know, like we feel towards things we're addicted or attracted to?
Yeah.
Did you feel that as the process went along, that you were more okay with that uncomfortable, you know, the you know, being with that uncomfortable feeling? Does that make sense?
It's as the process is going along. It's, you know, it's quite continuous. It's my working edge right now. If I didn't feel like I were making some headway, I wouldn't have spoken about it tonight.
I mean, on a feeling level, does that mean that you're more okay with just sitting with uncomfort and not engaging and not, you know what I mean?
Yes, and the answer is sometimes.
So, okay.
Yep. And it has to do with, you know, how much equanimity seems to be present at the time. I'm sure it also has to do with the state of my blood sugar, and so I'm trying to remember to eat things that don't have calories or whatnot, and in small quantities. So I never get ravenous. You know, that's one of the pieces of advice you hear a lot. And substituting, you know, part of it's just the physical act of having a food substance and putting it in your mouth and chewing it and swallowing it. You know. But overall, and the other thing that kind of kicks in at the same time, it almost seems, this always happens in some way, whenever a significant insight arises, it's usually accompanied by some degree of a feeling of self-compassion. The reason being that you've managed to take kind of another step away from the situation, you're able to see it in a little bit broader context, and then when you get some insight into the psychological suffering that gave rise to the craving, that is the craving in some ways, it's like, oh, okay, so that's what's going on, you know. So Gyal Rinpoche, in his book, The Tibetan Book of Living and Dying, he talks about how important he thinks it is to study the texts of the Book of the Great Liberation on Hurrying the Bardo, because they really have resonance in the moment, in the present time, on the understanding that we're being born and dying every moment. And so what feels like it's kind of going on for me is there is a certain kind of persona death going on, you know, a certain amount of grieving. It's like almost I'm throwing a weight from myself. Except the weight's over and it's time to, you know, clean up a little. And so there's a kind of a leave-taking that I feel is going on that's associated with saying, okay, at least I can see why it's going on now. It doesn't mean the urges have stopped, and in fact, you know, they're still pretty strong. But at least I feel like there is another way to understand what's going on. And so the ability to start exercising a little restraint seems to be progressing, you know, and because to the extent we want to continue, you know, to play with or contemplate that realms of existence teaching, you know. And this has also been my experience over the life of my practice. If, as every now and then, we can see that there's something we're really holding on to, that really, you know, kind of needs to be let go of, that there is this fear of what's going to take its place, if you're able to really follow through with the letting go, what tends to take its place is that, to a greater extent than before, the consciousness can find itself actually inhabiting one of those Brahma-Vihara realms. You know, whether it's compassion or selfless joy or equanimity or open-heartedness, that the energy that's been freed up finds itself spending a little more time in those states of mind instead. And
well, this is an area that has big interest for myself,
yes,
personally. So I find that I become more adept at being with the what I'm averse to when I'm more uncomfortable. And sometimes I just cave in and eat or whatever,
yep,
it is. And sometimes I don't. And the other thing is finding a replacement, you know, something that's more functional, you know, better food or some, you know, that's another strategy that helps,
yeah,
seems to help me.
Yeah, like Tanjev talks about, you know, if you're starting off on the Buddha Dharma path and you have this sense that, okay, well, I'm going to stop clinging, right? Big deal, it seems simple enough, you know, except you find that you can't. And so he said, it's a stepwise process, and step one is to get more strategic in your clinging. You start paying more attention to what you cling to, and you see if you're going to let go of clinging to things that are really harmful to you, and try clinging to the idea of enlightenment, for instance, for a little while, until you realize that it's just another form of clinging, and you let that go too, and then you're on to the next step. Please.
Oh, well, I guess that kind of helps my follow-up question. So, more like in loneliness or anger or frustration, once you have that insight and you realize that's what's behind what you're acting out on, I guess then what do you do about it? So the loneliness, it doesn't go away. How do you attempt to fix that or
sure,
make it better for yourself?
Well, loneliness isn't is a painful state of mind to be in. Pema Chodron, in one of her books, When Things Fall Apart, I think it is, she has a chapter in there called Six Kinds of Loneliness. And basically what she advises is renegotiating your relationship with loneliness, you know, to inquire into its nature and whatnot. So there are different ways to be with it. For me, when I'm feeling that way, it's simply recognizing that it is an uncomfortable state of mind. You know, that it's, that I don't want to feel that way, except that I do. And so Pema advises, inquire into why you don't want to feel lonely. So that's one way to go at it. For me, simply acknowledging that it's a painful state of mind. That when you acknowledge dukkha for what it is, then to some degree, quite naturally, a feeling of self-compassion begins to arise. Because what's happened when you really have a close look at the nature of the loneliness, feeling of isolation, and you know, not being connected to others or whatever, as that comes into focus, you say, oh, pain, difficulty, okay. And so instead of getting absorbed in the poor me, you know, like the Ojibwe saying, you know, at times I go about loss and self-pity, while all the time a wind is moving me across a great sky, you know, that instead of getting absorbed in the story of I, me, am lonely, it's like there is loneliness, and then as the perspective gets a little larger, it's almost as if you're reparenting yourself, you know, and you're like in a relationship with a lonely child, you know, that doesn't have any friends or something, you know, and so you can find yourself comforting yourself for feeling the way you are. And so that's the arising karuna of compassion, you know.
Thank you.
Please.
Okay, I just kind of want to riff around this topic a little bit. But when you were talking about noting that or noticing that the professor persona that you have inhabited for the last 30 years mm-hmm. is dissolving. Mm-hmm. On the one hand, it's an opportunity because it's an opportunity to understand the insubstantiality of the constructed
yes.
self.
Yes.
Right. On the other hand, the problem that retirement presents, well, I remember reading something that the Mayo Clinic put out about the elements of happiness. Mm-hmm. And one of them was to have a reason to get up in mm-hmm. the morning, to have a purpose.
Right.
So what happens here? You can't just observe the professorial self dissolve. On the other hand, as a Buddhist, why not? On the other hand, what have you got? You know, unhappiness, yeah. according to the Mayo Clinic. You know, it's a really interesting time for Buddhists as they approach retirement.
Sure.
Because it calls into question that fundamental teaching of insubstantiality mm-hmm. itself.
Right, these are all, you know, highly cogent points. They're all things that I've reflected on a lot. I think that for me, it's not like I feel I'm going to sort of cease to exist. You know, actually, if I can step into a state of anatta and stay there the rest of my life, that's not so bad. Except I know that's not going to happen. But there is going to be some means by which something gets reconstructed. You know, arising and passing. Some kind of new persona is going to emerge. So what I've been doing during this last few months is to start to look around at ways that I might be able to use some of the skill sets that I've developed over the years in other media and other environments than I have before. So like mm-hmm. one of the things I've really loved doing over the last 30 years when we haven't had a chance to go for long trips, but I really want to be close to nature, is I go out to Bar Lake State Park. You know, I walk around or canoe or ride my bike or, you know, take pictures or something like that. So I've volunteered to start working out there. Somebody gave them a teepee, and so we're going to develop a program on the history of indigenous peoples in the Colorado Prairie, and mm-hmm. kind of so that's something I know something about. So I'll do that. I ran this disaster management program at the school where I teach, and looking into with others. Developing a lay disaster chaplaincy program. There are various churches that are already involved in it. I'm kind of interested in seeing Buddha Dharma Sanghas get engaged in the same way. And so I'm looking at what a training program in that area might look like. So I'm looking for ways to still do the things that I'm interested in, just without doing it for the kind of gold stars and pats on the head that you get when you're doing it for a living. So I'm already mindful of the problem, and there are ways I would like to continue to engage in the world, but just not within the same construct. And we'll see. I might wind up doing those things, and might decide after a few months that there's a real something to be learned in the art of doing very little. So I don't know, but it totally is facing the unknown. You know, it's true.
So you have, you know, all this, you are 70 years old, and you have used your time well, supposedly, and you have all this knowledge, and really a lot of strength all around you, and society has accepted you, people love you, and all that. Compare that with a pubertal 13-year-old boy in Denver, Colorado, who is going to have to, who is struggling. I see them in my grandchildren, and I see how they struggle and how they suffer, and they don't have anything to fall back on, really. Then it's really part of their job is to go into the unknown and face their demons. And do you have any suggestions as to what I can do to help my grandsons have an easier time of it? I mean, that's suffering. I mean, that's really suffering.
Following in Don's footsteps several years ago, I spent a couple of years teaching Dharma at the Inmate Sangha at the Federal Correctional Institute in Englewood. And that's one group you don't have to explain dukkha to.
Yeah.
And their courage and their strength astounded me. You know, these people, by and large, got dealt a pretty lousy hand in life. You know, and they're doing hard time, a lot of drug offenses that didn't hurt anybody or anything. And if you're thinking about somebody who is facing, I mean, not, first they're serving their time, and then at some point they're going to get sprung, you know, they're going to get out, they're getting very little in the way of the kinds of assistance that would make them, you know, hireable and productive members of society, and they're getting ready to go out and face the world with that same question. Who am I going to be? How am I going to make my way in the world? You know, the only way I know how to make my way in the world got me in here in the first place. And so I think that, frankly, sitting here whining about retiring, you know, I'm extraordinarily blessed. I mean, that's not lost on me, I must say, especially given the gravity of the tremendous disparity in income and financial well-being in this country and around the world. So we should all have my existential angst, right? I think that dukkha is dukkha, you know, whether it happens to be this pretty minor form of it that I've been describing this evening, or people who are facing much more substantial life challenges, like your relatives. Our country right now faces some extraordinary challenges in terms of what its political future is going to look like. Who are we going to be, you know? I can't think of a time when I felt that the answer to that question was in such peril, you know? That question is like always before us, you know? Who am I? Who am I about to become? How are the ways that I think and speak and act now going to be determinative of who I am? And like in response to Don's question, you know, and I think this is another one for us all, what contribution can, or is it possible for me to make to a more skillful outcome? Yeah. And I think that, you know, there's a sort of kidding about it, but I think whether it's in retirement or in terms of the future of our country, doing nothing is not enough. Determining what skillful action is what we're called upon to do, I think. Okay, you burned up another 2 hours. Let's take just a moment getting back into the sitting posture. May we all live with ease, free of inner and outer harm. May we remember the happiness that lies within us and the importance of sharing it. May we be at peace with things as they are, even as we work for skillful change. May we awaken and be free.